The Road to Vienna. We waited until the worst of winter had passed before Papa began preparations for our first trip. The cold days dragged by one after the other. Outside, the Christmas snow fell. The bear and the witch and the giant roamed the Geistergasse, and children ran squealing from them in delight. Sometimes, as I watched from the window, I thought I caught a glimpse of Hyacinth walking with the wild bunch, his blue eyes flashing up toward me. Then he would disappear, leaving me to think I must have imagined it all. During those short winter days, Papa sat at the clavier with Wulfril for hours, praising his swift memory and his accuracy, clapping whenever my brother finished memorizing another piece or added his own flourishes to a measure. Wulfril hardly needed his instruction. One day, I came into the music room to see my brother holding Papa's violin, his shoulder barely big enough for the instrument. He was not only teaching himself the strings, plucking each one and figuring out the correct notes as he went, but inventing a tune. He was already composing. I had heard my father call other musicians prodigies before, but they were men in their teens and twenties. My brother was just a child. I stood frozen in place as I watched him. His eyes stayed closed, and his fingers fluttered as if in a trance. With me too, our father turned more serious, extending my lessons, noting my every mistake, and nodding in approval each time I played flawlessly. I savored every moment of his attention. Even when I wasn't at the clavier, I sat with my notebook in my lap, poring over the pages, in search of whatever magic Hyacinth had cast on it. I could see no visible change in the pages, but something had changed. I could feel the tingle of it in my fingertips whenever I brushed the paper. On a day when the spring thaw dripped from the trees, Wulfril and I stood outside the arched entrance to our building and watched Sebastian and our coachman drag trunks of clothing across the cobblestones, throwing them unceremoniously into our carriage's boot. Mama chatted with Papa as they worked. I could see her unfolding and refolding her arms in barely disguised anxiety. She did not want to leave home. "Their Majesties Emperor Francis I and Empress Maria Theresa." I kept my hands folded in my skirts and repeated their names silently. "Vienna's royal court." Mama had said that kings and queens are remembered. Perhaps being remembered by royalty was the same. Beside me, Wulfril shifted his weight from one foot to the other, trying in vain to keep his excitement subdued. His eyes were bright with anticipation this morning, and his brown ringlets brushed past flushed cheeks.
"What are we going to do for 2 weeks in a carriage?" he asked me.
I leaned down toward him and raised my eyebrow. "Having no clavier on the road does not mean you can get into mischief. Papa and Mama will not have it, do you hear?" Wulfril pouted, and I patted his head.
"We will find something to pass the time. The countryside will look beautiful, and soon you will get your instruments back." "Will they have an ear for music, do you think?"
he asked me curiously.
"The Emperor and Empress?"
I smiled at his boldness.
"Best not ask that question at court, Wulfril."
He tucked his hand into mine and leaned against me. I noted how much thinner and stretched out his fingers already felt. The softness of his youth was rapidly disappearing from his tiny hands.
"Herr Schachtner said the Emperor likes a spectacle," he said.
And a spectacle they would get. Wulfril's improvement on the clavier only quickened with each passing week. Papa had to commission a tiny violin for him. Before Wulfril, it was unheard of for a child his age to play the violin at his level. That quality of instrument simply did not exist in the shops. Our names now regularly circulated the Geistergasse, whispers on the tongues of the curious and skeptical that Herr Leopold Mozart's 2 children were in fact both musical prodigies. They would say my name first,
because I had played for longer. But they saved Wulfril's name for last, because he was so young. I tried to keep my unease at bay. I woke up early every morning of the winter to practice, staying at the clavier long after Papa had left for the day. I'd play and play until Wulfril would tug on my sleeve, begging for his turn. When I was not at the clavier, I tapped my fingers against the pages of my notebook and hummed under my breath. I spent my days wrapped in the music, lost in its secrets. When I dreamed in new measures and keys, compositions I would never dare write down. I was, after all, not my brother. Sometimes, over the long winter, I'd also dream of Hyacinth whispering in my ear, "Desire is your lifeblood, and talent is the flower it feeds." I'd wake and play his minuet on the clavier, the tune I had heard in the grotto, wondering whether it would call him back again. Perhaps he was watching us right now as we stood outside our home, his pale body washed warm by the light. Out of instinct, I tilted my head up toward our windows, certain I would see his face there behind the glass.
"Manuel?"
I looked down to see Papa approaching, and straightened to smooth my skirts. He placed one hand on Wulfril's messy head of curls.
"Time to head into the carriage," he said gently.
Wulfril released me, then ran off to hug our mother's waist, babbling affections all the while. Papa touched my shoulder and led me over to the corner of our building, so that we stood partly in the shadow of the wall's edge. I looked directly at him. I did not do this often. My father's eyes were very dark and frequently shaded by furrowed brows. It was a stare that dried my throat until I could not speak.
"Manuel,"
he said,
"this will be a long trip. I'll need you to keep your wits about you and conduct yourself like a young lady. Do you understand?"
I nodded quietly. Papa's gaze flickered over my shoulder toward the carriage.
"Wulfril's health has been delicate lately. All this winter air?"
I nodded again. My father did not need to tell me. I had always known this about my brother.
2 weeks in the carriage may wear him down. Take care that he does not catch a chill. The Emperor specifically requested his presence, and if we are to perform again in Europe, we will need Wulfril's reputation to precede us."
He put a hand on my shoulder.
"Be mindful of your brother."
I waited for him to tell me to take care too, but he did not. My hands brushed at the edges of my petticoat. Specks of dirt had spoiled the fabric's light color.
"I will, Papa."
He removed his hand. His expression changed, and he started to move away.
"The coach is almost ready. Come along, Nanril."
As I headed after my father, I watched Wulfril pull Mama's arm down toward him. I could not hear him, but his words coaxed a tear from her eyes, and she gathered him into her arms. Years later, I learned that Wulfril had asked,
"Mama, will you be sad when I grow up?"
We traveled along the upper rim of the Alps, where the terrain changed to gently rolling hills and patches of forest. Papa and Mama chatted together on one side of the carriage, while I sat with Wulfril on the other. The ride was so bumpy that I had to press him against the carriage wall to keep him from sliding around. While our parents dozed, I spent my time looking at the ever-changing landscape. The houses had grown sparse, and the sun shifted in the sky so that it peeked in just below the carriage window, bathing us in light. I smiled at the warmth, leaned closer, and narrowed my eyes. The passing hillsides transformed into a stream of colors, gold and peach and orange, hazy layers of billowing silk. Tree trunks blurred by. Beside me, Wulfril's eyes were half closed, and his lashes glowed white in the sunlight. His slender little fingers danced, composing in the same way I had seen him that morning with Papa's violin.
"What are you thinking, Wulfril?"
I asked in a soft voice. He opened his eyes.
I am writing a concerto, he whispered.
I nudged him affectionately with one elbow.
How are you writing a concerto, silly, with no paper? I can write it down in my head and remember it.
He rolled his eyes upward, thinking, then looked at me again.
I am imagining the kingdom.
His mention of the fantasy otherworld sent a familiar thrill through me. Wufferl had, for months after the incident at the trinket shop, asked me exactly what I'd seen that day. I'd told him about the clavier and the notebook, the grotto and the princeling. All I'd left out was the conversation between Hyacinth and me. It had seemed like a secret meant for no one else.
Are you now? I said. What does a concerto about the kingdom sound like?
He turned his large eyes on me.
You want to hear it?
He asked eagerly. I hesitated for the space of a breath.
Of course, I replied.
He cleared his throat and hummed a few bars. It sounded light and airy, not like the perfect music from my dream or the grotto, but instead like the scenery we passed. Somehow I felt relieved that it was so different. Perhaps the music from the other world was something only I truly understood. My mind returned for a moment to the moss-paved tunnel, Hyacinth's bright eyes and polished fingernails. Now and then I thought I could see an upside-down tree flash by our window, although I could never quite focus on it.
I like it,
I said to him when he fell silent again.
We should give the kingdom a name,
Wufferl announced. I shoved him, glancing pointedly over to our sleeping father.
A name,
he repeated in a whisper.
All right, a name. What do you want to call it?
Wufferl closed his eyes. I watched his sun-soaked lashes resting against his cheeks and wondered for a moment if he had fallen asleep. Then he opened his eyes and flashed a grin at me.
Let's call it the Kingdom of Back, he declared. What a curious name,
I whispered.
Why?
Wufferl looked pleased with himself.
Because it's all backward, isn't it?
He replied.
The trees turned on their heads, the moon's where there should be sun.
Now he was turning playful from restlessness.
And does that mean the people are backward there too?
I teased him. Here, in our sunlit carriage, the kingdom seemed just a figment of our dreams, Hyacinth a fleeting memory.
Were we backward?
He giggled.
Everyone is backward.
At that, he offered me a mock frown, an imitation of a backward smile, and tried to flip the syllables in his name. It sounded so garbled that I covered my mouth, trying to stifle my laughter. He shifted in the carriage seat toward the window.
Backward,
he repeated to himself.
I'm going to put that into my concerto. Are you going to write it down when we reach Vienna? Yes. The whole concerto? I am almost finished with the first movement.
I shook my head gently at him, disbelieving. Then patted his knee.
Surely you can't remember all of that. I would not be able to hold such a long piece in my head.
Wufferl simply shrugged.
I can.
Then he uttered a contented sigh and rested his head against my shoulder. As he did, he hummed under his breath, so softly that I could barely hear him. But I did. And this time, the sound struck deep within me. I recognized the kingdom in his melody, at once sweet and beautiful, newly formed, in a minor key that made it sound like a place that could never quite settle. At first, I heard echoes of Papa's rigid teaching, but I could also recognize the parts that my brother drew from my own playing, the pauses and crescendos in his measures. I could make out the way he was turning my inspiration, the sound of my yearning, into his own. How, in a way, he was taking what I could do and improving upon it.
How silly I was for thinking, even for a moment, that Vufril could not create something beautiful enough for the kingdom. I closed my eyes, dizzy, envious, wanting more. This was not the composition of a child. Within it was the wisdom of an old soul, not the innocence of a young boy. No child could create a piece like this and keep it all in his mind. And as I thought this, as I listened in awe to my brother's raw concerto, the memory of Hyacinth came to me in such a strong wave that I opened my eyes, shivering, certain he would be sitting in the carriage with us. But he was not there. Papa still sat across from us, dozing with his chin resting against his hand, while Mama leaned against his shoulder, swaying in her sleep. Still, I felt the ripple of something strange in the air, the heady sensation of a new presence. Through the window, something pale flashed by among the trees, a glimpse of glowing eyes. In an instant, the kingdom and the princeling no longer felt like a faraway dream. They were very real. And they were here. Suddenly, the carriage lurched to one side. Mama gasped. Papa startled awake with a curse on his tongue. I cried out. My hands flew to the carriage wall to keep myself from falling forward. Our trunks clattered free of their ties and careened out of the boot, landing with a crash in the dirt path outside. We settled to a halt in a cloud of dust. Papa was first up on his feet. He scrambled against the slanted floor until he could pull himself out of the suspended door, then reached over to hoist my mother out. I grabbed Vulfril's hand. He was crying. He rubbed at his head, and between his fingers I could see a pink mark growing from where he had hit his forehead against the edge of the carriage window. When I called for him, he reached obediently for me, and I lifted him around to Papa's outstretched hands. Together, we helped him make his way up. I went last. We found ourselves at the edge of a forest, dense with oak and spruce, its canopy so thick that hardly any light reached its floor. I peered around for a moment, blinking dust out of my eyes. The road we'd traveled wound in a slender arc, its bordering trees trailing off into mist, and ahead of us stretched more of the same. In the middle of the road lay one of our carriage's wheels, which had somehow come completely off its axle. Faint lines carved in the dirt curved up the path from where the carriage had passed. I trembled. My eyes searched for a lithe figure crouching in the trees. While Papa retrieved the wheel and helped the coachman lift the carriage enough to replace it, I studied the tangle of trees surrounding us, looking up on an impulse into the thickness of their leaves. Beside me, Vufril bent down to pick something out of the dirt.
"Nonra, look,"
he said, holding an object out to me. When I peered closer, I saw a blue rock in his hand, glowing faintly as if lit from within, its grooves striped and strange like a seashell's. I turned my attention to the other rocks strewn across the path, and when I did, I noticed that hidden underneath their coats of dust were glimpses of bright blue, an entire spread of shining, sharp fragments that had jolted our travels to a full stop. At first glance, they looked strewn in a random pattern, careless stones clumped with twigs and fallen leaves. But looking closer, I realized that the tracks our carriage had left behind looked like two long sets of lines in the dirt, unmistakably reminiscent of the kind that make up bars of sheet music. The shining blue rocks lay glittering across these lines, round notes winking at us in the afternoon light. My lips parted. I found myself humming the tune on the ground. The notes littering the path changed to music on my tongue, then drifted into the air and faded away. Vufril listened in wonder, his eyes fixed on the sight. I looked over my shoulder into the forest. An uneasy feeling seeped into my chest, coating my insides and pushing against my ribs until I could hardly breathe. Was it simple coincidence that the wheel had come off from the side where Vulfril sat? Coincidence that this happened right as I felt Hyacinth's presence in our midst, after Vulfril hummed his composition. My brother still rubbed at his bruised forehead, although he made no more mention of it. Deep in the forest, the wind blew a tuneless song through the leaves, and in it, I thought I could hear snatches of a voice I recognized all too well. Something quivered at the edges of my sight, a blurred figure. I knew that it would vanish if I tried to turn toward it. I took Vulfril's hand and made him drop the blue rock. He uttered a sound of protest and looked up at me with wide eyes.
"Let's stay near the carriage,"
I said, guiding us back toward where Mama stood.
"They are nearly finished."
And so they were. We began to board the carriage again, and when I glanced back at the rocks, they seemed quite brown and ordinary. The lines carved in the dirt looked more like carriage tracks this time. Only the whisper in the leaves lingered. Even as I shrank from the sound, it beckoned to me, tugging at my dress with an irresistibly coaxing song, the words almost comprehensible and yet completely foreign. As if spoken in a backward language.
"You have not forgotten me, and I have not forgotten you,"